This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.
I'm Matt Callanan. I'm a former international DJ and music producer turned podcaster, filmmaker, and founder of the kindness project We Make Good Happen. Like your life transformed with new opportunities? Would you like the same status as a book author? Would you like increased sales for you and your business? I've achieved all of this by doing this exact podcast. Now I'm training people exactly like you in a super easy style how to launch a successful podcast. Just go to podcastlikeapro.co.uk. That's podcastlikeapro.co.uk. Thank you. Hello and welcome to the We Make Success Happen podcast. Today, we're live in Dublin with the amazing human, Myron Murray. Hello.
Thank you. I think I'm human anyway.
So we've had the Good Summit. How did it all go and what did you get out of it?
Yeah, so it was an amazing kind of gathering of people and people telling positive stories, inspiring each other, really kind of sharing hope, I guess. You know, I think the theme this year was it was the worst of times, it was the best of times, or maybe it's the other way around. But, you know, I think it's pretty appropriate. Like, it is kind of overwhelming, the challenges that we face today, and we need to focus on the positive because otherwise you'd just be paralyzed with worry and anxiety and fear. And so for me, I think that's what I kind of try to do. I try to let's focus on the positive. I'm aware of all the negativity, but I'm not going to dwell on it because it would just, as I said, it would just overwhelm you. So that's why I think the Good Summit and events like it are so important, because people are brought together. So they're brought together. You know, you meet random people having a coffee, you know, you hear people in panels and then you can go up to talk to them afterwards. It's that kind of randomness of people, almost like gathering around like a campfire, like we did as tribes, you know, as in Ireland, probably the same, I'm sure, in Wales, whatever, on Bratton Bheag, to give it its Gaelic name. You know, so like this is something it's intrinsic to humans. You know, that's what we need. We need to be able to gather with other humans, with other people, you know, look, you know, see people, you know, actually make eye contact, you know, give people a hug, have that kind of tactile closeness that you don't have in terms of kind of online communities. It's so important to have that meeting of other people.
So do you think if we need to solve the world's problems that we need to do it as a group, as a collective?
Absolutely, we'll have one huge festival. We'll have another Live Aid for the 2020s or whatever. Like, yeah, so of course we absolutely need to bring people together. You know, the challenge is, and this is the whole challenge for Tech for Good as well, like how do you harness the knowledge, the skills, the ideas and share them? And how does tech enable that to happen?
Yeah.
So for me, of course, absolutely, we need people to be involved as individuals in terms of the choices they make. If we're talking about, you know, the climate emergency, it's both. You know, I'm kind of a big fan of non-binaries. So for me, it's both. We need kind of individual action as well as systemic change and lobbying for that change. Yesterday at the Good Summit, I was hosting a panel about environmental engagement, and that came up as a big discussion. You know, kind of the anxiety that people have around the climate emergency, because they're like, oh, like, okay, I forgot my keep cup today. Does that mean I don't have a coffee? Or, oh no, you know, I want to go to an environmental action group meeting, but I need to drive. So does that mean I don't go? You know, you could paralyze yourself in terms of individual decision making. It's really important that, yes, we do, you know, we take responsibility. We do what we can, but that we don't, you know, go overboard to the point that we kind of lose ourselves in trying to be purists about anything. So I think absolutely as individuals, we have to feel empowered to make small changes that are contributing to a bigger picture. But of course, there needs to also be the lobbying, the campaigning, the changing, you know, and, you know, of the systems, of the incentives, you know, we need change on a bigger scale as well.
So do you want to talk about your involvement with Tech for Good and what you hope as a group to achieve through it?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, I mean, I can't even remember when I first heard about Tech for Good. It's like, it's not one of those moments like, oh, Tech for Good. So it kind of gradually came up I think it must have been a hashtag or a term that started being used, I guess, in the press and the media. And I was always like aligned to it. I was like, oh, this is what I do. But I didn't realize it was called Tech for Good. Really through Twitter, myself and Ellen Ward connected with this amazing guy, Elijah from NetSquared. And he was saying, oh, look, we have other Tech for Good events and groups. Why not set up something similar in Dublin? And we were like, yeah, sounds good. So yeah, so that was really kind of it. You know, I've kind of a background in organising on conferences in the past. You know, when I worked in the BBC, for instance, I was involved with the whole campaign around, you know, kind of online mobile tech platform and offline events. So kind of organising events is something, you know, I just get a buzz from and I love. And I kind of thought, okay, let's do something in Dublin as well. So yeah, so that's how we started. Now, we're not a group as such. I kind of see it much more as kind of a loose community, a grassroots movement, because people can opt in, they can opt out. You know, you don't have to sign up to the mission of the group or something to come along to it, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think in a sense, looseness and non-rigidity is important, because things shift and change. You know, even the whole Tech for Good movement and the focus of Tech for Good will evolve. So things do change. But really at the heart of Tech for Good, Tech for Good, I suppose, is all about harnessing technology and using it for positive social change. So focusing on purpose, not profit.
What sort of things have come out of Tech for Good then? Or some of the companies that have been involved in making that change for good then?
Like, there's so many. I'll have to open my laptop in a second to look at them all. Yeah, so we started off, I think the first event we had, Lai along from TechFugees, which was fantastic, talking about TechFugees, which was the tech community response to refugees. So he was talking about a lot of the work that was happening there. Like, there's been so many. I know yesterday at the Good Summit, we had the amazing Talita Holzer from Way to Be. Way to Be are really involved with Tech for Good. As I said, they've been involved in events and they've been really supportive of other initiatives we've had as well. And then yesterday we also had Ronan O'Dally from Thriftify. So they're like two amazing Tech for Good companies that are totally driven by purpose, by the vision they have to improve things, to change things. And they're also very much looking for, you know, they have business models, they have plans for investment. So they're just both kind of, as I said, amazing examples of Tech for Good on the ground that's happening here in Dublin.
Why do you think more companies need to be driven by purpose instead of, I mean, profit's important if you want to, you know, make change, positive change, but why should companies care about purpose?
Well, the thing is, I know companies are meant to be entities and they're meant to be almost like, they're not humans, but they're meant to be, you know, organisms of them their own. But like, at the end of the day, companies are made up of people as well. And I don't think a company can abdicate, I suppose it's kindness. It can't abdicate its responsibility by saying, oh, it's not the individuals who are making these decisions or, you know, who are driven in this way. It's actually the company. So to me, of course, a company is a legal entity, but at the end of the day, people should care and people make up companies. So of course, companies need to care. Things are changing and, you know, I'm not by any means mad an expert in this, but I know things are changing in America, for example, there's a lot of change around, well, who are companies accountable for? Are they accountable just for their shareholders, or do they need to be accountable, for example, to their staff, to management, you know, to their customers as well? So in a sense, companies were always the heart of a community of sorts, a community of individuals, a community of, you know, staff members, customers, whatever. But they didn't see themselves that way. You know, the legal entity was, it's a separate entity that's focusing on profit and focusing on profit for the shareholders. So it's really good that there's that shift happening. And, you know, companies are now being seen, and a lot of them are embracing this idea that they're not just about the profit and about the shareholders, but they're also about, they have a responsibility to everyone, to the community in which they're located. It's not even just the, you know, their employees, but the community in which they're located, their business model. That's a bit, you know, that's really important. Like, is their business model one which is causing some kind of negative disruption in our society, in our communities, for the sake of profit? So to me, the purpose of a company and its business model, that's, you know, that kind of really determines, you know, is it having a positive impact or not? You can't just say, oh, the product itself, oh, it's really having a positive impact. You need to look at, well, what's the business model? How are workers treated? You know, are people being, you know, there are a lot of companies where there's a whole gig economy, for example. There's a, you know, I'm sure we're all aware of that, but there's been a lot of, you know, kind of media coverage about the gig economy in terms of the erosion of the rights of workers and the impact that that's having on them personally, on their mental health, you know, on the impact on their families, not knowing what their salary is, that they have some kind of baseline salary every month to pay their way, to look after their families. So to me, if a company needs to look at all the different ripples and impacts it's having, both in terms of its product, both in terms of its, you know, its business model, so that's all important.
What were the couple of objectives associated with Tech for Good that you mentioned?
Yeah, so I mean, as I said, Tech for Good, in some ways it's kind of like a hashtag. So we can you can decide if you're going to use for, the integer for, or for.
Yeah.
But you know, in some ways, like Tech for Good is a hashtag, and it is about highlighting and showcasing examples, positive examples of technology. And on one level, that's absolutely what it is. As I said, it's quite loose. So I kind of like to see it as a movement, in the sense that it's kind of grassroots, it's bottom up. There's no manifesto that you need to follow or sign up to. For me, Tech for Good, there's a few different strands to it, and people use the term slightly differently. So on the one hand, people talk about Tech for Good, and the focus is the digital transformation of charities and not-for-profits. So that's really important, because, you know, simple things can really transform the efficiency of how charities work. You know, it might be simple, something simple like they've got a WordPress website that they can update themselves, or, you know, that they're using some kind of newsletter or MailChimp in a really effective way, so that they can reach out to their supporters in an effective way. So the digital transformation is about using tools, digital tools, to make the charities and the not-for-profits more efficient, in terms of how they fundraise and in terms of how they meet their charitable objectives. Because digital technology, there are a lot of really simple tools to use that can really transform a charity, not just fundraising, but how they deliver change, because so many charities are about change. So it might be about, you know, creating an e-learning course to support, you know, to support carers, or you might be kind of just, you know, developing video content in terms of sharing stories that empower and inspire people. So for me, digital can be absolutely, you know, can be used by charities to transform what they do. So there are Tech for Good groups that are kind of focusing on that. For example, the Tech for Good group in the UK, in the Southwest, they have a real focus around digital transformation, and they're doing really kind of amazing work in that space. One other strand of Tech for Good is around, which is the area that I'm really into, which is around innovation. So it's about, you know, starting with a problem, a challenge, you know, something you want to change, and really thinking through, well, how do we come up with some tech solution that is going to actually be transformative, make a huge difference, and really kind of solve some challenge, whether it's on an individual level, whether it's on helping communities, whether it's, you know, helping the environment. So that's what really excites me, is kind of thinking through, well, what are the challenges that we have, you know, as individuals? Maybe it's around having some disability, maybe it's about our communities, engaging communities so that they connect with each other, whatever it is, you know, thinking of a problem, saying, well, okay, well, how can tech really deliver a tool, deliver a solution? And that's the bit that really inspires me. And as I said, there's so many amazing innovative Tech for Good products and companies that are in Ireland and kind of beyond as well. And I suppose the other strand of Tech for Good is more about, I suppose it's more around kind of the ethics of tech companies, which is there's so many different levels to this. You know, it's whether, you know, in terms of the workers' rights within companies, in terms of their right to have a voice, to protest. In Dublin, quite recently, there was a walkout of some Google employees who were really unhappy with how harassment had been dealt with at a management level. So, but there's also been Google walkouts where engineers are saying, okay, we're not going to work on products which are about weaponizing, or creating weapons and going to be used as creating tools for war. So in terms of holding tech companies to account, that's another, I suppose, aspect of kind of tech for good. And of course, there's also the whole area of kind of the ethics of actually the technology, especially around things like AI and data in terms of transparency, the diversity of data sets. The impact, like how do you measure the impact of something? How do you know the impact of a tool that you're creating? I think that's something that really interests me, is because so often, like a lot of people talk, and I'm a great, you know, one of the best for talking away or whatever, but sometimes you have to say, well, okay, am I having impact? And what is that impact? And can I really measure that? Now, obviously, it's hard as individuals, but if you're creating a product and you're creating a product that wants to do good, well, you need to say, well, hold on a second, has it done good? Because look, we've all done it, we've all done products that sound really cool and there's been a lot of buzz and excitement, but you're like, at the end of the day, that hasn't really made much of a difference. Like, you know, it's been a nice project to work on and, you know, we all feel good at the end of it, but have we really made a positive difference, and can we measure that? Is it tangible? Have people changed their behaviour? Have people's lives improved because of engaging with a product? So that's an area that I'm really interested in, is how we measure impact. So that's in terms of tech for good products. How do we know that a tech for good product has made something positive and good? But also in terms of holding of other products, which may have, you know, which may be kind of benign or just a kind of profit driven, are the products having a harmful effect? And how do we measure that? So that's a really important challenge, I think, at the moment. So in terms of, for example, AI and ethics, it's not just around the start of a project when you're planning the project and the data set and you know, thinking through the consequences, potential consequences of something. What are the consequences that, you know, kind of at every decision point? Decisions aren't just made at the design stage. It's also made in execution. It's made when you get feedback from customers. But also, as I said, how do we measure the negative impact that we're having? And it's something that, you know, I'm really interested in doing a bit more, kind of a bit of research on, is, you know, can we use data and AI in a sense to police itself? Can we use AI as a way of policing AI, for want of a better word, you know, to see, well, okay, for example, if we created some intervention, can we then say, well, okay, this is actually having a negative impact on people's mental health, or a positive impact? And we have the data to show it, so that we can say, well, hold on a second, this product is negative. This product is having a negative impact on individuals, on society. So I think that's really important, that we get to a point where we can do more than just talk about things being good or negative, but that we actually, that we can actually prove it, that we have the facts, that we have the data.
Some people are quite concerned about AI and how far robotics can go, especially in the wrong hands. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, on one hand, like robotics are really, they're fun. I kind of like them, because they're almost kind of like magic. You know, there's a robot and, you know, it kind of walks and talks. We actually have an amazing tech for good robot that's been developed in Trinity called Stevie.
Okay.
And Stevie the robot is helping people live independently at home. So Stevie's very much about, I'm not sure, yeah, it must be a man, I'm thinking, he's called Stevie. So Stevie is, you know, he's a good robot. The purpose of Stevie is very much to help people, to enable them, as I said, to live independently. So, you know, robots in themselves are not good or bad. You know, it's what, you know, they're not all going to be killer robots that are going to come after us.
Yeah, can Stevie robot protect us?
Exactly. We can have our own robots that will defend us from the bad robots. But yeah, so in terms of robots, yeah, to me, yeah, that can work either way.
Mm.
So it's not something, to be honest, I spend much time worrying about or you know, sleepless nights about, is, you know, the future invasion of the robots. Are they going to be clever than we are, and we'll have a war with, you know, war with robots? I think we've more more issues to worry about in terms of, you know, the planet, in terms of humans, in terms of the negative impact we are having, you know, on the world around us. That I think that's more of a worry than the robots. Yeah, so AI, again, it's amazingly powerful because it's really looking at patterns, you know, and predicting. It's very simple in some ways, you know, it's just looking at patterns and then predicting future patterns based on those patterns. So in some ways, it's something we've always done. So it's really looking at the world around us, learning from it, and then kind of based on that world around us, can we make kind of predictions? But obviously, one large concern is obviously around, well, what data is there? Because quite often when you look for data, like on the one hand, we're told, oh, the world is awash with data, we have so much big data. But then when you look for specific data, it seems to be missing. There's a lot of missing data as well, which could actually be used to highlight areas of injustice and areas of concern. For example, maybe the connection between, say, homelessness and people who've been in foster care. You know, often when you want, you know, when you look at a specific problem, there's a lot of missing data. But in terms of AI, as I said, it's really very simple. It's about pattern recognition and prediction based on patterns. But it's not, it's this whole thing of correlation versus causation. So just because there's a correlation and there's a pattern where things happen when other things happen, it doesn't mean that one is causing the other to happen. And so it's not a prediction in the sense of one snooker ball hitting another snooker ball. It's not predictive in that exact sense. I think the bigger issue is around values in terms of what values we want to have as a community and as individuals going forwards. And to be honest, those values are changing so rapidly in terms of environmental justice, in terms of this whole kind of crisis around the environment. So our values do absolutely change. They're not set in stone. So I think that's the bigger issue in terms of, can we at this moment in time have a vision of and an agreement around what our values are, and then use the tools, use AI, use whichever tools we're going to use that are in line with those values. I'm not a historian at all, and that was my worst subject, and at least it is when I went to school.
Why? Like, what grade did you get?
I didn't even do it because it was too much rote learning. I couldn't hack history or whatever. So it wasn't my favourite subject. But I do think it's really interesting because, like, even if we look at, say, like the Victorian era, and I know I know a little bit about this, but in terms of how their vision and their values impacted how they built things. So how they built, for example, even prisons were based on this idea of, you know, that light and transparency of prison cells and open spaces created better people and created people who would, in terms of their morality, in terms of their ethics, who would improve and who would change and who would, you know, change for the better. So they had this whole vision in terms of how they built prisons. But if you look at prisons today, because I did a project where I was in a prison a few years ago, it was actually in Edinburgh, and it was so hideous. There were narrow corridors, kind of low ceilings, very few open spaces, real sense of claustrophobia that you wouldn't get in an amazing prison like Mountjoy, you know, here in Dublin, which is one of the top tourist attractions as well to go to. So it's quite interesting. So I suppose the key thing is that the values underpin everything. And, you know, we're never going to get an answer. Technology will never give us the answer in terms of what we should or should not do. That's where we have to have a vision of what a good society is like, what a good life is like. It's those really basic, fundamental, philosophical questions. That's what needs to drive the technology. And that's what we need to come back to when we're kind of not clear in what the direction we need to go in.
What do you think some of our values should be in the future from here on?
Oh, gosh, that's a bit of a big question. I don't know about. I wouldn't. It's a tricky one. So, like, I studied actually philosophy as my first degree. I kind of, at that stage, I really felt I needed to know, to explore purpose for me, you know, as a young woman. That was my biggest need, was to figure out, well, how do I have, you know, what can I do with my life? How can I make a positive difference? What am I here to do? How can I contribute? So that's why I studied philosophy. But philosophy does not give you any answers. So you
just opens up more questions,
well,
does it?
You go into these spirals of questions. So when you study philosophy, I've always been kind of into arguing because growing up we were always debating and arguing, so I was always good at that. But you even get better at it because, you know, you can see logical flaws in other people's arguments, which is useful. So I studied philosophy in Trinity, but that was very much focusing on, as I said, logic, reason, very kind of analytical, really useful skills, you know, because it is important to realise, you know, where we're basing ideas on, what our ideas are based on, and what our thought processes are. But it didn't give any answers around what is a good life, or what values matter. So things that really matter to me are things around kind of equality and diversity. As I said, you know, growing up north, I was really privileged. You know, I lived in a beautiful part of the world. You know, we weren't hugely impacted in any way by the Troubles. Maybe it was in County Down, you know, hidden away up a laneway, you know, those hedges and hills all around us and whatever, and foxes and badgers, and I was very, very blessed. But, you know, growing up as well, of course I became aware of the society around me. There were things happened every day, there'd be a story, you'd see the news and you'd be so shocked. And the most shocking thing was that you couldn't even speak about it, because this is, I suppose, it gave me an insight in terms of conflict and polarization of thought. Because growing up north, if you said, oh my gosh, that was dreadful what happened last night, whichever side it was, or whoever, you know, because everything there became polarized, that there were two sides, you were immediately perceived as being justifying, or, you know, that you were in some way condemning or siding with one side or the other side. And it still happens, even up north now. I see on Twitter where Naomi Long, she has to condemn absolutely everything. Otherwise people are like, hold on, you only condemned that. You didn't condemn that. You didn't condemn that. But as I said, you're kind of aware of that whole dialogue and discourse around equality, around being a minority, because growing up, you know, I came from a Catholic background. I was a minority. I was brought up speaking Irish. I was a complete minority in County Down. There were hardly any other families that spoke Irish then. And you become aware that growing up north, being a Catholic up north, I was in a minority. And that's a really fantastic lesson, because then you can have that empathy with other minorities. So to me, that's, again, I would say that is actually a privilege. If you are in a position where you can recognize your privilege, and also recognize that in different contexts, we are the minority, we are the privileged, and we are the underprivileged. You know, it's this kind of getting away from these kind of like binary positions. So I think that obviously kind of impacted as well, you know, that I'm very much kind of driven in terms of issues around equality, diversity. You know, they kind of really matter to me.
Now, you did a great TEDx talk. What?
So did you.
Thanks. What tips would you give to someone who thinks they've got a TEDx talk in them?
Well, I'm sure we all have many TEDx talks in us, you know, because, you know, you did a TEDx as well, Matt, so you know the whole idea is, oh, you know, you focus on one idea. I think it's good to do a TEDx talk because, you know, it's one thing to talk and to do, or do a podcast or whatever, or to do, to write a blog post. But when you're doing a talk that has to be a certain length of time, that has to focus on one big idea, and that really has to connect with, you know, it has to connect with my 12-year-old nephew and my, you know, 78-year-old mother, in a sense, you know, they both watch kind of TEDxes. It's a good discipline to kind of really carve out your ideas and think through, well, to carve out your ideas and also carve out a story. It's a really good thing to do. I know yesterday at the Good Summit, you know, Dave Linton was going on about the importance of a story. So, you know, Dave Linton at the Good Summit, he was saying, oh, look, people relate to stories, and a story often is more important, even, you know, in terms of startups, than a business plan. Because he went back to his black bin bag story, you know, and he was saying, oh my gosh, recognizing a moment when you say, okay, this is the story, this is the nugget of a story, is so important for yourself in terms of your personal narrative, but also then in terms of when you're communicating that story, that vision for change to other people. So with the TEDx, in a sense, I suppose it was kind of retrospectively thinking of the story, thinking backwards, you know. So, I mean, in terms of technology is a term. So the TEDx was about tech for good and the tech for good movement. I did it along with my co-founder, Ellen Ward, and we were really privileged to be invited to do it, kind of based word of mouth through other people who'd heard of what we were doing in terms of the tech for good in Dublin. But as I said, there were certain little nuggets that I'd picked up that kind of, it's almost like things just that excite you, you know. And one thing that kind of really interested me was, you know, being from where I'm from. But it fascinated me, this idea, like, you know, that Ballygowan means town of the blacksmith. Like, there's another Ballygowan in Tipperary. I think there's a few others as well. That's the where, you know, the water comes from, obviously, which, you know, also was town of the blacksmith. But it just fascinated me, this idea of, and like, you know, there are blacksmiths in my family. Like, my grandfather at one point, you know, and great-grandfather, they were blacksmiths from County Armagh. But it was this idea that, you know, the blacksmith wasn't just the person who put the shoes on the horses. And I mean, I suppose that was important because the horses were like, they were the vehicles, you know, it was horse power. So, you know, horses mattered. But I love this idea. Well, actually, they were more than that, which I'd never thought about. They were actually engineers. They were craftspeople. They were product designers. You know, they were techies. And I love that idea of thinking through, you know, that right throughout time, there have been people who've made tools and who've really served their local community and used technology. So that was just something that sparked. It's just for me, it kind of, it's not why I got into technology, but something just that sparked something in me. And then when I was kind of researching it, it was just like, oh my gosh, I was researching about iron and stuff. And I was like, oh my gosh, like they speculate that actually in the Iron Ages, people would have extracted iron ore from meteorites. That would have thought, so it came from like outer space. Like, that's just amazing.
I love that.
Isn't it so cool? Yeah, it's like so cool. So this idea, you know, that we are all connected, even as a galaxy, like, it's really, really amazing. It's really, really cool to think about that. So anyway, so that really inspired me. And I suppose the other kind of local inspiration is, as I said, coming from County Down, like so many places, you know, in Ireland or whatever, there's so, if we look beyond the surface, there's so much evidence, you know, for our ancient civilization that has gone back, you know, way beyond, you know, in terms of the pyramids or whatever, you know, if you think about Newgrange, it's older than many pyramids. So our civilization is so ancient. And that really inspired me as well. But also more recently thinking about, you know, medieval monks, this whole idea, you know, that Ireland was once known as the land of saints and scholars. You know, that was always something that inspired me, the idea that this tiny little island, you know, on the edge of nowhere, at one stage had so much learning, had so much thought, had so much hope. Yeah, so I think that the whole idea of monasteries, for me, are really inspiring because they really were, I suppose in some ways they're like universities, the way some universities are, where they really serve their local community, where they're centres of learning, communities of learning, but they're really focusing on real issues and really kind of transforming the world around them rather than being kind of stuck in an ivory tower. Close to where I live, there's this amazing, like, it's, if you saw it, you know, again, you would need to know what it might just look like, an old stone wall or whatever with a bit of a round tower. But it's the remains of this ancient monastery of St. Mohi. And I would have gone there regularly as a child. And it's on a tiny island. So where I live is in Strangford Lough. There's all these tiny islands. Some of them are joined by little roads and things. What's so amazing is that in the 7th century, the monks there developed the first tidal water mill in the world. So to think that there was this world innovation happening in the 7th century, you know, a few miles from where I live, it's just amazing. And I find it so inspiring. It's this whole idea that we can get inspiration from the past, you know, as well as, you know, kind of visioning towards the future, you know. So I really kind of draw a kind of strength and inspiration from that. And I think, oh my gosh, you know, in Ireland, we have that history of engineering, of invention, of creativity. You know, so often Ireland is kind of viewed as a place of storytellers and, you know, writers and poets, you know, but it's more than that. You know, we have that history, you know, and maybe that's in my DNA. Who knows? Do you know? Maybe I'm a descendant of some kind of like monk or whatever. Who knows? But it's amazing when you kind of think of that and think, you know, with so little connectivity, there was, you know, in terms of digital connectivity, obviously, but they were connected. That was what's so exciting as well. Like, you know, travel and connectivity isn't new. People travelled by boats. People travelled between, you know, the monks travelled all across Europe. You know, there are trails. People in Germany are, you know, a lot of them are kind of, know all these Irish monks. You know, towns in Germany are named after them. So they did travel as well. But it's this idea as well of connecting. Connecting really inspires me.
What would you say to those people that feel like they've got a story, but maybe have got a fear of getting up on stage and telling it? What would you say to those? Or how would you advise those people?
Gosh, I don't know, because I find it scary as well. So I don't know. I mean, I suppose I have been lucky because I have had lots of different trainings along the way, and I've actually been training people in the media and different media skills, like myself. We work together in the BBC, and there was a fantastic scheme there called the BBC Young Reporter Scheme, where we kind of were training, you know, young people and teenagers in terms of telling stories and using the media and, you know, sharing their voices and, you know, capturing the stories of others. I mean, to be honest, I'm much more comfortable drawing out other people's stories than telling my own story. I've always been more comfortable with that. But I think sometimes there's a responsibility as well to tell your story, because you're kind of you're making a marker there. You're being a role model, I guess, for other people to say, well, okay, like, that's amazing. I could do that as well. Or, you know, there are different ways to progress in life, to contribute in life. So I think it's that idea that if, you know, we gotta practice what we're preaching, and if we're talking about, you know, women, you know, having voices, women being, you know, perceived as being leaders, well, then it's up to each of us to find that inside ourselves, that kind of courage, I guess, to kind of tell our own story, to share our ideas, you know, to have impact in whichever way we can, you know, and to have an audience, because there's no point just, you know, telling my brilliant ideas, which I think are brilliant, whatever, to my mum or something, or, you know, your best friend. You kind of think, well, hold on, we need a bigger platform. As women, it's important that we have bigger platforms, that we can contribute to discourse, you know, at a national level, a decision-making, a policy level, as well as having a banter, you know, over a Prosecco or a flat white, you know, in the pub or the local coffee shop.
How do people find that courage then?
It's tricky. It's so tricky because, and the thing is as well, I'm a big, you know, we go in circles of being more courageous and less courageous at different times of our lives, just like we go in circles of being stuck and then, you know, really moving forwards fast. So, like, I remember when I was 13, I was doing a debate called Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And I'd written all amazing ideas that I thought were fantastic ideas. I was arguing that there's girls are more serious, which I absolutely believe. We're not, you know, girls don't just want to have fun. So that was the case I was arguing. But I just went up, and it was only a small thing. It was like an after-school debating club. It was the first time I'd been, but I went to pieces. I started laughing hysterically, which is what I do when I get nervous. And it took me, I don't know, 10 years to ever like take part in a debate again. A lot of us have horrible experiences where we kind of, you know, you fall to pieces, or your voice gets dry, or you, you know, with nerves, you're kind of just, your legs collapse under you. So we've kind of all been there, I guess. I suppose what's really helped me is that I have also been involved with yoga. I'm not going to say meditation, because I don't practice it every day, but I've been on a huge amount of like retreats, meditation retreats, all sorts of holistic healing retreats for like literally years. And I've had so many amazing teachers, and some of that must in some way have rubbed off on me, I think. You know, at some level, that has given me, I guess, a level of centeredness and courage. And I know some simple things I can do now, you know, if I am scared, you know, like breathe, you know, whatever, focus on this idea of being rooted in the ground, and take inspiration from other people. Like, I think of certain women in history, ones who are really brave and who are ready to put their lives on the line. And I'm like, okay, look, I have to take courage from that. And that's where I think role models come in, that they can really almost transform our energy when we think of somebody who really inspires us in their energy, and we think, okay, look, what I'm doing, it's really trivial. It's not really that scary at all. And just kind of really kind of harness that courage and bravery. I think it's something, yeah, I suppose I've developed different ways to deal with it. But look, I can still go do something and go to pieces in the morning. You know, when your brain and your mouth, they just don't kind of coordinate or whatever. And I've also learned not to drink coffee, actually, before I do any speak, whatever, because then I just get totally hysterical,
yeah.
You know, because once you've got the adrenaline rush, you know, the adrenaline rush, the nerves, and then coffee, which I'm very fond of, you know, I think it's not a good combination.
Have you got a little routine then that you do if you're going to do a big talk?
Not really. I mean, for the TEDx, I practiced a huge amount, which I never do because I'm always winging it. But for the TEDx, I totally, you know, practiced. I mean, you were lucky you weren't drafted in, Matt, actually. I think you were one of the few people I didn't contact. No, I did. I contacted a lot of the community, the tech community in Dublin helped. The TEDx team in Limerick were amazing. You know, Ellen, you know, my co-founder, whatever. You know, there was a huge amount of people who were so generous in terms of ideas, or listened to early scripts or listened to early pitches. And they were fantastic in terms of giving me little nuggets to maybe add in, or, you know, it was that dialogue. It's through dialoguing that we kind of get to, we clarify our ideas. So, yeah, so I think with the TEDx, it was definitely a huge amount of practice. Normally, I always have plans that I will do a huge amount of practice, but it always seems to be that, you know, I lose the run of the day or something. I get distracted or end up doing something else, and then I'm kind of slightly winging it. But no, practice makes such a difference. And I suppose the only thing I'd say is, as well, is obviously, I'd say to people, don't be writing down an essay and trying to, you know, because we speak differently to the way we write. So, I mean, that's just a kind of a basic, you know, a basic tip in terms of storytelling. When you're storytelling through audio or video or you know, being on stage, you know, we speak differently than we, as I said, there's no point writing an amazing essay and reading it out. You have to kind of get the dialogue and get, you know, it has to be authentic.
Mm. I think what really helped me was actually just, and anyone can do it now, they've got a phone, is just put a, record yourself, watch yourself back, and you're like, oh, really, did I say that? You know, but actually watching yourself back, and you have to get over that awkwardness, I guess, of seeing yourself on camera and speaking, and you're like, oh, do I really look like that? Do I sound like that? I mean, I have a thing where I'm still learning all the time, but I kind of look down when I'm thinking. And of course, I need to kind of look up and actually engage with people, because I think as an audience member, when you're watching it back and I'm looking down, it looks like I'm disengaging. But really, I'm just kind of thinking, when really I need to be keep my head up and look at people and try and engage with people more while my brain's kind of thinking about, did I say that right? What am I saying next? All that kind of stuff. But yeah, actually watching myself, recording myself and actually seeing yourself stand up, and that's really helpful, and that's kind of helped me get better. And that's why I always get someone to record me just so I can watch it back, just for my own going, all right, that bit worked. Okay, got laugh there. Okay, I need to be looking up more. I can see myself. You know, so it's that constant learning, I guess.
It is. No, it is. And it is a skill, and it's something that, as I said, you know, I'm just learning as well, absolutely. But no, I got amazing feedback. You know, there's a fantastic guy, Dave Waters, who was so generous, and he was like, oh, you have to record. I only want to see a video of you. And I was like, oh, do I have to? So I did like a video just at my laptop, and I was just reading it out. But even that, I suppose, was good, because he said, oh, look, be more animated, or, you know, have more emphasis or more whatever. And like one of my best friends, Helen Callan, who actually lives in Wales, like she's a proper reporter presenter. So she was so cool, because she kind of I had a Skype call with her, and she showed me even least simple things that you'd never know. It's like, you know, if you're pointing to the screen, you know, the screen behind, but you're saying, you know, look at that picture on screen, that you do it in a certain kind of like jerky way that's kind of unnatural but looks good, rather than, you know, sweeping fluid movements, you know. So, you know, yeah, absolutely. There's a real art to it, and there is so much to learn. I haven't focused too much on learning many more skills about it. Like, it is interesting, but as I said, I don't think of myself as being a presenter or, you know, a speaker. I mean, I suppose I should maybe invest a bit more time and effort into it, but I always get caught up either in, you know, kind of the ideas or in the doing. I suppose I'm very much kind of a production person. I mean, that's how we know each other from the BBC. We're both producing. I love to make things. I love to be working on a project or a product, not thinking through how will I tell a story. Well, I mean, that's part of it. Well, I suppose in terms of how I tell my own story, that's always then squished in at the end, and thinking through, oh, well, I better share what I'm doing, otherwise everybody will be wondering what I'm up to, you know. So sometimes it's an afterthought.
I mean, who are your role models, and what did you kind of learn from them?
Well, I suppose my, I mean, some of my role models are kind of historical, so we don't, you know, so they're kind of slightly maybe controversial. But yeah, so I suppose courage. I suppose that's what I learned from some figures of women in history, in Irish history. You know, it is that kind of absolute courage, you know, which, as I said, I'm very lucky, because I don't live in a time of conflict. You know, I'm not putting my life on the line, in a sense. But I think there are amazing women throughout history, throughout Irish history, which I know a little bit about, but, you know, throughout history everywhere. And you kind of think of the bravery, the courage, the absolute determination. And as I said, that gives me courage in situations where I'm kind of wavering. I suppose also it's not so much a role model, but it's, you know, people who I've known, people who I've gone to school with. Sometimes you hear about some people, you know, who kind of die young or whatever, and you think, gosh, that's, you know, such a terrible waste. And that then you kind of think, well, look, so that back to that idea of like seizing the day. You know, it's like that movie, The Dead Poets Society, which I'm sure we've all seen. And, you know, it's inspiring. It's that idea of, like, you know, seize the day. You know, there's no more time for waste, for there's no more time for thinking or, you know, going backwards and forwards, or, you know, thinking what you should do or being paralyzed by possibility. Or, you know, sometimes we just need to act, and then when we act, that has its own momentum, and things happen when we kind of do and when we act and we meet people, and then we're living rather than thinking about it. So I think that's the thing. It's very much, you know, doing and acting. So having that momentum rather than being stuck in, you know, thinking, oh, what if I do this and will I do that? And because I wasted years, you know, in states of total indecision. And then it was just like, you know, you get bored with yourself because you get bored. You get bored listening to yourself, having the same conversations with friends and family. And you're like, oh, my gosh, what is, you know. And the thing is, I would never take advice from anybody, but I would ask everybody for advice. But I would never I would never take anyone's advice. I'd then talk to somebody else and ask them for advice in the same situation or whatever. You know, and I lacked that clarity of saying, OK, this is what I'm going to do. This is what feels right for me in terms of my values, in terms of, you know, how I'm feeling, more feeling than thinking, and then just acting and just kind of going with it. So that's something I've learned in the last few years, is very much kind of to go with my gut instinct and think through, okay, you know, this idea that we do know, we're asking people for advice and whatever, but we know ourselves the answer, but we're too scared to go with it, because we're maybe afraid of failure, or, you know, we're afraid of success or whatever we're afraid of. You know, fear can really stop us from doing things.
So how do you get over that fear then?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of, well, I really don't know, Matt. As I said, I think it was just because I did so many different things. As I said, you know, I've done yoga for years, I've done Reiki, I've done so many different kind of different things that on some level they must have, I don't know, I don't even know what it means, energy, but on some levels I think I changed from indecision to clarity and decision, you know, where decision making became a lot easier for me. I'd say I'm a very determined person. You know, I am determined. I will make decisions. And if I am not making decisions and I'm back to, you know, will I do this? Will I do that? Should I do that? Asking people, I'm like, hold on, what is going on here? Do you know, I know it's a real sign that something's not quite right. And I have to really kind of think, well, you know, what's going on here, and change, you know, and change what I'm doing.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in taking action. Because do you think if you act first, possibly when you don't have all the courage to do it, do you think taking action helps with the courage and almost like validates your idea and action?
Sometimes you fail and you do something and you're like, oh my gosh, that was really not the right thing to do on so many levels. So action is not always the right thing to do, or the, you know, sometimes the choice is not to act or not to change things. My dad was an art teacher. One of his best principals, one of his best managers, you know, was somebody who did almost nothing and let people get on with it. You know, sometimes doing nothing is the best option, you know, or doing the same thing, you know, not changing course. So for me, I suppose for me, it's been a really big learning, is not to change direction or change, or, you know, or to act in terms of changing, you know, the direction I'm going in. Because, and then that's been a really big lesson for me the last few years, is constancy. I just realised that it was a real problem I had, staying constant. Mm. You know, staying, basically just staying. This is my life lesson. Do you know what I mean? To stay. You know, even when, you know, when I want to run away or do something different, because I get excited by things very easily. So I'm like, oh, I'll do this, or I'll learn this, or I'll move to this city. So for me, it's like, okay, stay. You know, just stay, and, you know, stay focused, just stay. So for me, that's been really, really interesting. It's just, you know, when you get that self-awareness and you think, oh gosh, this has been a challenge. And if I maybe change how I act, then other things change as well.
So what's the thing that you're most proud of, or you think has been most successful for you?
Gosh, I don't know. That's a really hard question to answer. I don't really think of, you know, I don't have a list of, oh, these are my achievements, or this is what I'm really proud of. It's tricky. It's a tricky one to answer. I try to be open with everyone I meet. I try to, you know, be the same in that sense, you know, in terms of being myself with whoever I meet. And, you know, I'm very much into kind of fostering kind of community and trying to give as much as I can. So I mean, people always say, oh, you're really good at connecting, or you're really good at networking. I hate that word, networking. But, you know, I do like connecting people. So, gosh, man, I don't know. It's really tricky. It's a really tricky one.
What brings you the most joy then?
I mean, I do get a buzz from so many different things. Like, you know, I get a buzz when I'm kind of like organizing an event, you know, when people are learning and when people are meeting each other, you know, that gives me a huge amount of kind of joy. I suppose if joy is kind of being in the flow, you know, I also love it, you know, when I'm working with clients, you know, when we're kind of brainstorming some solution and, you know, when things all just come together and you have that kind of kernel, that nugget where you're like, oh my gosh, that's the magic. That's the brilliant idea as I see it. Of course, it may not be so brilliant, but, you know, but I love that kind of creative process, but creative, not in the sense of painting, but just creative in terms of, you know, people collaborating together. And when there is that kind of energy in the room where people are really positive, where there's that enthusiasm, where people are growing, where things are, you know, where ideas are forming, of course that does give me kind of a lot of joy, that kind of facilitation, you know, facilitating other people, coaching other people, cheerleading them along. I mean, that gives me a lot of joy, which in some ways, to be honest, is like being a teacher. Which is kind of the irony, because both my parents are teachers and I was like, oh my gosh, that's a thing I'll never be a teacher. But in a sense, that is what gives me joy when I'm in that role of teacher, coach, facilitator. You know, when I see other people kind of growing and blossoming and, you know, coming up with ideas and sharing together. Yeah, that gives me a lot of joy.
Yeah, I think you're a great connector of people and communities, and you're a great cheerleader as well, and I think that's really appreciated by a lot of people, because the world needs cheerleaders of people doing good and that sort of thing. So yeah, I really appreciate that, and I think big kudos to you for doing that. So last question then, imagine all your friends and family are sitting on a lovely beach and it's a lovely sunny day and they're looking out to the sea and the blue sky, and we've got the little plane that's been hired by you with the message behind it, and these are your words of wisdom. What would it say on that banner? What would your words of wisdom be?
Oh gosh, I don't know, because, well, I'm a big fan of shanachles, which are in the Irish language, they're like proverbs and words of wisdom. And, you know, in our family, we always try to write one down, you know, for birthdays. I often Google them because I can't remember them or where the fadas go. But, you know, I mean, there's one that I do always go back to, which is Gerara Kela Toctur and Cashlon, which is, you know, little by little, you know, we build a castle, which is this idea that we can, you know, have, you know, everything we do, there might be tiny drops in the ocean, but like they're gradually building towards, you know, something really big, something really important. It's by small steps and small contributions that, you know, we change the world.
I really like that. That's a good one. So where can people find out about you?
Gosh, just as long as they can spell my name, they can Google me. They could find
me
anywhere.
Do you want to spell your name out then?
I think I'm the only Maureen Murray I know of on the planet. But yeah, so as long as you can spell my name, you can find me. So it's Maureen M A Fada, IRIFADAN, Murray MURRAY.
And what about Tech for Good? Is it like hashtag Tech for Good?
Absolutely, Tech for Good Dublin, Tech for Good. We've got a website, techforgooddublin.org. And we've got, you know, we're in Meetup, you know, so on Twitter, we've got a Twitter's handle as well, Tech for Good Dublin. So yeah, it's easy to get hold of me and easy to find out about Tech for Good Dublin.
And Tech for Good happens all around the world, isn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. Like, it's popping up everywhere. There's such interest in it, and people are organising their own Tech for Good, you know, events in Dublin. There's been loads happening. So as I said, nobody owns it. It's up to everyone to use it, you know, to get involved and to think through how tech can make a difference.
Well, I appreciate your time, Maureen, and great panel hosting at the Good Summit yesterday. It was really good. So really appreciate your time. Amazing human, Maureen Murray. Thank you very much. Hooray!
Yay.
Subscribe, rate, and review the We Make Success Happen podcast.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, I would really appreciate you leaving us a great review up on iTunes or your Apple Podcast app. It means a lot. Thank you very much. I've been Matt Callanan, and I'll see you on the next episode.
This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.